Good morning. So last time we talked about LEA, so the load effective address instruction, and mainly talked about it because the way it doesn't deal with memory often causes confusion. You mentioned the effective address is the address computed in the middle of an instruction. So we said, like, if we have a move from memory to a register, the effective address for that move instruction is the address at which memory is accessed. So LEA, it has an address that it looks like from the assembly syntax would access memory, but instead of accessing memory, we just take that address and put it in the destination register. And we mentioned one other thing which was confusing about this, which is that, well, we have this syntax we mentioned is for specifying addresses. It has even these special features for dealing with arrays. And often we will see LEA used using this syntax for things that really aren't addresses. And why would that happen? And so one reason is that the processor doesn't really care if they're addresses. The processor does some computation, and it only matters if it's a real address or not when we're talking to the memory. So if we don't talk to the memory, we don't care that the thing we're computing is never a valid place in memory. And for this reason, LEA is often used by compilers for non-address computations. It's just a convenient way to do certain computations. And so you'll see it used that way. So then we talked about how control flow works in assembly. So you've done control flow before in 2150, but we had this compare and conditional jump instruction. We didn't talk about how they communicate with each other. And we said that the way this works is with what are called the condition codes, which are special one-bit registers that contain various information about the results of the last piece of arithmetic. And the two big ones that we're going to deal with this semester are ZF, the zero flag, for was the result zero, and SF, the sign flag, for was the result negative, which is also a copy of the sign bit of the last computation. There's also some flags for overflow that I want you to know exist, but we're not going to go through when they're set and when they're not set. And this was set for all arithmetic you mentioned. So then we had, well, what's comp? That instruction that you probably thought, you know, were told, oh, this is what you use with conditional jump. Well, that's a subtract that just forgets to store the result in the destination register, but it still updates all the condition codes. And all our conditional jump instructions are named after what happens for subtraction, or another way we can look at them is they're named after comparing to zero. So jump equals is going to check the zero flag, and we call that equals because if we do a subtraction and we get zero, well, the two values we subtracted from each other were equal. And finally, once we knew how condition codes work, we talked a bit about sort of the process for converting control flow to assembly, sort of the way I like to do it, which may or may not have been what you did in 2150, of sort of first getting rid of like if else's and turning them into this go-to or if go-to, which we know we can translate very directly into assembly instructions. Questions about the things we covered last time? So when we left off last time, we also looked at converting loops into assembly, and we follow the same process except we have some go-to to go to the beginning of the loop. And I mentioned briefly that, well, there are actually multiple ways of doing this, and you'll see compilers do a bunch. We have these examples of the compilers trying really hard to reduce the number of instructions in the loop by doing more and more complicated things. So from the first to the second version, the compiler said, oh, I don't need this jump and a conditional jump. I can just do a conditional jump at the bottom, but I need some extra setup. In this third version, the compiler said, oh, I don't need a counter that goes from 1 to 10. I can have a counter that goes from 10 to 0, and then I don't need a compare. Whether that's a good idea, well, this is why we have the compilers have the option of deciding what makes sense. We also finished up very briefly talking about how switches to be compiled. So you mentioned that switches are one case where it's not so obvious what the translation to assembly should be. In fact, compilers will do all these options of this sort of if-else option. This is kind of equivalent to if equals 1, go to 1, if equals 2, go to 2. Or if less than 50, do the check the lower cases, if greater than 50, check the higher cases. Or we mentioned the strategy of a table. Just have, so the code for this might look something like this, where we have this table with a bunch of pointers, which I label quad because they're 8 bytes. And the way this works is that in memory, we have this big array of addresses of the code for case 1, case 2, and so on, and we just do an array lookup, this jump instruction. So questions about loops or switches? Okay, so let's talk a bit about how programs work, how we make executables. So this is an example of what this sort of traditional layout of a program in memory looks like. So we have a stack, typically starting at a relatively high address. We have some addresses higher than that, typically used internally by the operating system. We have a heap, which is where things that are malloc or new would go. And we have writable data, which is like global variables, for example, and code and constants for our stack. Grows typically on x86 downwards towards the heap. We push like arguments that don't fit in registers on there, local variables, save registers, and so on. And we have these empty spaces in between. We'll talk later in the semester about what's actually going on with that, these big empty spaces. And besides the stack and our heap, we have this sort of data that's for global variables and code and constants, and this is typically what is loaded from an executable file. So an executable file basically contains that data. So we have our initial values of global variables, all our code, all our constants, and things are typically set up so these can be loaded pretty directly from our executable. And there's some steps in there that you've seen, but we haven't looked in much detail. So let's say I have a program here where it prints hello world. And the process we've learned is that that gets compiled into assembly. That assembly gets converted into this .o file. And that .o file gets turned into an executable. And we're going to talk about what's this intermediate step here. So in that .o file, we have machine code, and well, isn't that what we want to load into memory anyways? So what's missing, what's happening in this linking step? And the big thing that's happening in this linking step is that the assembly file, if you look at main.s, isn't going to contain the code, at least not most of the code, for puts. So we need to add some extra code to make our executable. So in this example, I'm saying maybe it's in puts.o, could be in something with a different name. And the linking process is combining these different object files that contain machine code into an executable. So questions about this setup? And you can use your compiler to do any of these steps. So we have our compile option, which converts C to assembly. We can convert from assembly to an object file, and we can take an object file and link it. And you might say, wait a moment, didn't specify puts.o. What one of the things that might be hidden here is that even when we only have theoretically one file making up our executable, the default that compilers do is they typically link in a standard library, even though you don't specify it on the command line. So even though here I'm only specifying one object file, the compiler, unless I tell it otherwise, is going to assume, oh, you also want like printf or cout or whatever. It's going to add that in. And very often, you'll use the compiler in a way where you'll do multiple of these steps at once. So for example, if you take a C file and produce an executable directly, the compiler is in fact doing all these steps internally, it's just only giving you the final result. So something we want to talk about is why do we want this object file step? Why do I have this separate linking step? Why am I not just taking the assembly file and directly producing an executable? What extra work makes us want to have these object files? And way of thinking about it is here, let's say we have two assembly files. So I have an assembly file for my hello world, and I have an assembly file for putS. And let's say we wanted to combine them. So what we're gonna do is we're basically gonna concatenate them. That would actually work. But a problem with this is that if this is our approach to making executables, is combining the assembly files we need into one big assembly file, then converting that to an executable, then we're generating machine code for this putS code here a lot of times. And that's something we'd like to avoid. We'd like to not have to keep regenerating the machine code for putS every time. So the goal of object files is to just have the machine code generated once, and then we're done. But that's not actually so trivial, and the main reason why is we have these labels in here. And to make the machine code, we need to fill in these labels with the actual addresses of things. So we need to figure out where does main go, where does putS end up. And if we're combining these files, well, that's going to depend on what's in the other files because we have to find room. Yeah, so because we're going to do this process where we sort of convert these all to addresses as part of making the machine code. And this means that if we want to have, say, a version of putS that's already pre-converted to machine code, we have a bit of a problem in that version of putS is going to have some places in it where we need to figure out what goes in there. And it's not decided yet because we don't know where putCare is going to end up, for example. And if we want to pre-convert main to machine code, we don't know where putS is going to be. We don't know where the string is going to be. And in the machine code, these need to be numbers. We can't do that yet because we don't know where everything is. So object files are going to give us a way of having this conversion to machine code, but handling the fact that, well, we can't actually fill in all the machine code. We have these extra numbers that we need to fill in later, and the object files are going to give us the information to do that later, even though we're pre-doing the machine code conversion. So we're not going to have to, every time you make an executable, go through all the instructions in putS and convert them to machine code. But we're going to be able to fill in the spaces in those instructions where we have to figure out what's the address of something actually in the executable that's going to depend on what else is in the executable. So questions about this sort of motivation for object files? Yes?
So in summary, the solution to the problem that you can't put labels in machine code is the object file?
The solution to the problem that we can't put labels in machine code is the object file? Yes. And we're going to see the sort of strategy that it takes for that. Other questions? Okay. So let's look at what's in this file in this example here. So we have our putS hello world. And here's a more realistic version of hello.s. And I'm showing it in AT&T syntax. I could have also had it in Intel syntax. I'll talk about some weird things that the compiler did here. So So one thing is that you might say, what's the subtract and add that does nothing? The calling convention on Linux says that the stack needs to be a multiple of 16 address when you call. And it starts out as not a multiple of 16 because call pushes something. So that's why this add and subtract from the stack pointer here. This XOR here is a way of setting EAX to zero because in my initial example, I didn't implement the return zero. So it does sets EAX to zero to return zero. This dot global here is used to mark that the name main is going to be used by other files. So if I don't do that, the assembler might not make that name available. We'll see in object files how that name is going to be made available to other files. Okay, so we've seen this .s file, and let's talk about our object file for it. So the main idea of the object file is we're going to pre-do the conversion of this to machine code. So I'm going to write out what's called the text segment. So that's marked with .text up to the part which says .data. And I'm going to write out the machine code for this. But you may remember that I said we can't actually do all the machine code yet because there's some place, because I don't know where putS is. I don't know where the string is. But we'll talk about that later. We'll talk about how did we deal with that later. We're also going to write out the data segment. So I'm going to also pre-convert this string into the appropriate bytes. And on this slide, I've written everything out as hexadecimal. Typically, object files will just have the raw bytes because they want to make the linker as fast as possible. And it's a lot faster to just copy bytes from one place to another than to convert from hexadecimal to bytes. But I'm showing them as hexadecimal because we couldn't read it if I wrote the raw bytes. So we have this conversion into machine code and the raw data, the bytes that we're going to want in memory later on. So we have, for example, the subtract instruction. This happens to be the x86-64 machine code for it. It's these 4 bytes here. Now, we also have the labels. You might say, what do we do with them? And what we did is we just left them with some value. We put some value there. So for example, these 4 bytes here in blue represent the address of the string in the move instruction. And we've just left them as a placeholder value that doesn't matter. We have to put something there. So we put something there, but if we just put this in our executable, it wouldn't work. We'd be placing a null pointer instead of the string pointer. And similarly, this call to putS, I had to put something representing the address where putS is going to be here, but I just left a placeholder that if I put this in executable, it would crash. Would end up calling itself the way the call instruction works and crash. So I have these places where my machine code is incomplete. And I'm going to need to deal with that later. And the other thing we're going to put in the object file is the information to do that. So I'm going to write what are called relocations. And we can think of them as ways of changing the location that these labels point to. So initially they point to some junk. We're going to make them point to the right place. And the table of relocations, in this example, it says, oh, in the text segment, at byte index 5, replace it with the address where the data segment beginning ends up. And that's handling this L string, because it's at the beginning of the data segment. We wrote that down and said that later on, when we make the executable, we need to do this replacement. And I said, oh, in the text segment, byte index 10, replace that with the address of putS later on. So we've written information for the linker when we make our executable that says, here are the places where the machine code's incomplete. You have to fill it in this way. So questions? So people, yes?
Does the object count as any, like,
The question is, does the object file have bytes that indicate the following bytes need to be replaced? So typically the structure of the object file is that there's some information saying this is an object file, and it's divided into these sort of parts that have these different meanings like this. So a part which is, here's the machine code, here's the data, and a part which is, here's a table of things, and here's another table of things, and so on. I'm saying typically because there are a bunch of object file formats out there, so there's other ways you could represent this information, but typically they want the machine code to be something where you can basically just copy it and then do little fixes later rather than scanning through it. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
In the text segment, what are BF and
EA? Question, in the text segment, what are BF and EA represented of? So the actual whole move instruction, that's our second line, is here. So the BF is part of the machine code for the move instruction. It turns out that x86 encodes that it's a move and that it goes to RDI in one byte. And we've only specified the part which represents the address in the table of relocations. Does that answer your question? So something that that brings up, the question brings up, is that this table of relocations, you can do what that says without knowing what any of the machine code does, right? We can fill in those blanks without knowing that we're filling in a move instruction. We just know there's something to fill in. Other questions? Okay, so there's one other thing we need to write down. So I mentioned that we marked this main that might be used by other files. So we're going to have what's called a symbol table, where we're going to say the name main is in this object file, and if something asks for main, it's text byte 0 of this object file. So one thing that you may notice is, wait a moment, this L string here, why didn't it show up in the symbol table? And we've just made a choice. That, and the convention on Linux is that .L things are just labels that are local to the file, so we're not going to bother writing them down in the symbol table. And this is why in our relocation table we've just given sort of this relative idea, because you can't use .L string from another assembly file. Okay, so we have this object file, and we're going to eventually make it into an executable. And basically what the linker is going to do is it's going to take the code from the text segment, it's going to put it in the executable, and it's going to also add in the code from, say, standard AO.0 that we also need. And it's going to take the data segment and also add in the data from standard AO.0 that we also need. So it's going to put it all together, and it's going to fill in those relocations based on where the string ends up and where putS ends up. And that's going to be our executable. And what we're going to end up with is we're going to end up with something that the operating system can copy directly into memory to start the program, rather than needing to do any sort of processing when we actually run the executable. So that's all going to be done in advance when we produce the executable file. Questions? About this process. Okay. People are less confused than I used to for this topic. Okay. Well, so let's do size. So here's a C file. So let's say we produce, this is main.c, and I produce main.s, and I convert that to main.o, and I make that into executable called main.exe. I'm asking which of those contain the memory address of say hello. I look in those files, which of them will I find the memory address of say hello? Give you a minute or two, you can check with your neighbors, see if you agree. Okay, who would like some more time? Okay, some people. Okay, so let's see. Okay, so who thinks A, B, C, D, which is both B and C, okay, few, E, and F. Okay, so we have pretty good consensus that the executable is likely to contain the memory address of say hello. I think that's generally likely. It's going to have it somehow encoded in the call instruction. Turns out that it might be encoded in some less direct way than just writing the memory address. So for example, in x86, the call instruction often, rather than saying call an address, it says call the function that's like 1,000 bytes away from here. But that's a way of encoding the address, so just not directly. Then we get into the object file. So we have some disagreement about whether it's in the object file or not. Someone want to defend either side? Yeah. Okay, so you said, oh, when I look at like this call to puts here, I just had this replaced with puts. I didn't have an actual address for it. And therefore, so there's only a placeholder. therefore we don't have the real address. Okay. So anyone dispute that idea? Or have other things we think we need to consider? Yeah. Question, won't the address be containing the relocations? So you mean here? Like, so this here, okay, so that's a good question. So I wrote address of put S. And what do I mean by that? So what I mean by that is, this is kind of the note from the assembler to the linker, and it doesn't say that the assembler doesn't know where put S is going to end up in memory, because that's going to depend on the code from standard IO.0, which we aren't even looking at yet. So what's written there is actually the name put S wherever you find that. But that's a good, yeah, something to, good thing to clarify here. Yeah. Okay, so then your argument is, wait a moment, so we were all talking about what happens when we have a call to something where we need a relocation, but in this case, we have a symbol table entry for it because some other file could call say hello, and that needs to be in the symbol table. And the symbol table, and this is a big, contains an address for the function. So if you look and see here for main, the symbol table entry for main tells us where main is, but it doesn't tell us where it is in memory. It tells us where it is in the object file. So it has an address, but it's an address in the object file. It's not a memory address because we don't know where we're going to put that code in memory yet. We haven't decided that. But it does tell us where to find it in the object file, which is very important, just not in memory. Okay, so questions? Yeah, so I think that C is the best answer. I can see arguments for, you know, but is it really as an address in the object, in the machine code? Maybe it's not, but I would say C or maybe F are the right answers here. Yeah.
Before we move on, could you go through what was in each file again in general?
Can I go through what is in each file in general?
Yes, the
.s.o. .s. So .s files are, you've seen before, 2150, they are assembly. So they have, you know, instruction names, register names, they have labels that are, you know, marking things. .o files try to convert that as much as possible to machine code or bytes we can load, but we have these holes that we have to fill in later with, you know, actual addresses that we don't know yet, either because we don't know where the code will end up in memory in this file, or because it depends on other files that we don't know about yet. And it also has information for other files that want to refer to this file where things are. Okay, and executables generally are produced by combining the object files and filling in those placeholders to produce something that we want to be able to load directly into memory. Right, so goal to make our operating system efficient is that when we start a program, we copy from the executable file into memory pretty much directly, so rather than doing lots of processing. Yes?
Since the executable file has the memory addresses in it, like, if my computer can run two executable files at the same time, and both things can access at the same
time. So the question is, since if we're choosing the addresses when we make the executable file, doesn't that mean that two different executable files would use the same address? Yes, and we will learn about a mechanism called virtual memory, which explains how we can allow two different programs to think they're using the same address much later in the semester. And I guess I also will probably mention briefly some other strategies for dealing with that too. Okay, so a second question. Which of these files contain the string, the literal ASCII string, hello world? So I'm asking here, if I open these up in a text editor, for which of them am I likely to see hello world somewhere in the text editor? And obviously, if I open up an executable in a text editor, like a lot of it's not going to be very intelligible. But I'm asking, will I see hello world mixed in with possibly unintelligible stuff?
Professor.
Yeah. Question, do I mean to see the words hello world or bytes represented? That I mean that if I interpret the file as ASCII text, will I see the text? Well, am I likely to see the text hello world? Who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks A? Or just A, I should say. B, C, D, which is both B and C, and E, all of them? Okay, and F, something else, like none of them or something. Okay, so we seem to have a plurality on A and B. So let's talk about this. So let's start with main.s. So I think main.s, I would say, probably contains it because the most natural way of writing the assembly, you're going to have hello world in the middle of that assembly. It's not impossible that it wouldn't be there. Like the compiler could generate like this code. That's fine. Don't know whether it would or not, but wouldn't be shocked. Probably it will contain it. And when we make the object file, we're going to have that data ready in the form. We're going to want it in memory somehow. And a complaint you might have is, wait a moment. When you show this example here, this doesn't look like hello world. This is hexadecimal. So typically, in object file formats that are used commercially, they're designed for efficiency. And it's not very efficient to, first of all, store all your strings in a program twice as big in hexadecimal, and secondly, to have to like convert them when you copy them into memory. So we're not going to do that. They're typically going to be stored in the object file as the actual bytes we want in memory, which is going to be ASCII because that's how we store strings in memory on our systems. And this makes the job of the linker simpler because the linker just copies those bytes. It doesn't need to like convert those bytes from hexadecimal to something else. And in the executable, we could hypothetically store our executables as sort of hexadecimal like this, but we really want it to be fast to load main, and it's going to be fastest if we don't have to do any processing of the actual bytes that contain our strings. So it's probably going to be in the ASCII form that we want it to have when we're reading it from our char stock. So I think for this reason, probably the best answer is E, though, you know, I can see why, main.s doesn't have to contain it. We could imagine some object file formats that would represent it in some other way, but that seems a little inefficient. And we could imagine having the executable format represented in some other way, but that seems like it makes it slower to start an executable. Because ultimately, in memory, we want this ASCII string. So questions? My answer here. Okay. Yes?
So just to confirm, just having the letters A, G, L, L, O, and so on, that's not ASCII.
So the question is, what do I mean by ASCII? So all these files are a sequence of bytes, right? Right, and so I'm saying, is that sequence of bytes the letters H E L L O as when we interpret it as ASCII? So, what I mean by that is that, for example, that this second assembly file here wouldn't qualify, even though, yes, this represents hello world. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, so it's just what it looks like when it's stored rather than how we look at it on.
The question is, so it's how it's stored, not how we look at it? Yes. This is what I was intending to ask in this question. Okay. So I got some other notes about linking. There's two things. So one thing is, what I've shown you so far is that we produce an executable, and we load the whole executable every time. And that contains sort of puts and all the things. And that's not often what's done. There's something called dynamic linking. And the idea of dynamic linking, well, okay, there's multiple ideas, but one important idea is that, let's think of printf, for example. So printf is a C library function that lots of programs use. And it seems kind of silly that we would have, every time I make a program that uses standard AO.h, it has its own copy of printf. We'd like instead to have one copy of printf that everyone uses. And this is in fact something we do, where we have one file that contains our copy of printf. So in Linux, this is often called libc.so. And all our executables that use printf, so like here I have, say, ls and emacs, rather than actually having their own copy of printf, they're going to somehow refer to this single copy of printf. And when we load those executables, we're somehow going to load one copy of this .so file, for the code for printf, and call that. So we're not going to talk about all the details about how dynamic linking work, but this is typically the default on when you compile an application, is that some libraries like this, to avoid having lots of copies of them, will have them loaded at runtime from another file, and we'll have some way of making it so at runtime you do part of the process of linking to make your calls to printf go to that loaded file. And often, the way this works is, to make this fast to do when we're loading a program, is maybe we'll replace the calls to printf with the calls to a table of functions, and we'll fill in that table of functions when we load the program. And filling that table is pretty fast, relative to replacing all the call instructions, like I showed you doing for making an executable, which we don't want to do all the time. And on Linux, there's an LDD command that will show you what dynamic libraries a program uses. So for example, on my laptop, I ran this on ls, and it shows me that when I run ls, it actually loads a bunch of different libraries into memory in addition to the code in ls. And the idea is by doing this, we only have one copy of these libraries on my system, not one for every program that uses them. So for example, this libc.so.6 has the code for printf, and I only have one copy on my system. Each program that needs it can load it, but I don't need to have, you know, every executable store its own copy of all the standard C library functions. And this command also shows, in parentheses, the address at which these libraries are expected to be loaded. Okay, so questions on our very brief mention of what dynamic linking is. So I guess the distinction would be dynamic linking means when we're doing part of the process of filling in those blanks when we load the executable because the code is in a different file. Yeah. So the question, if you want to share an executable with other people, would you want to use static linking? So static linking means that if there's something weird about the copy of libc.so that I have, you won't care about it. So maybe you'd want to do that, but typically operating systems are set up to make it so usually it will work if you share something that's dynamically linked, as long as someone has the libraries you're looking for, and you could also distribute copies of those libraries, those .so files on Linux. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so another thing to mention is I sort of showed in our object files that you're filling in blanks with addresses. Sometimes machine code doesn't use the addresses as is. So for example, a call instruction might be encoded as call function that's 4300 3 bytes later. And rather than filling in an address, the linker will have to compute what's that number of bytes later. And how do we support this with our object files? Typically, there's an extra field in the relocation list that says, here's the type of thing you need to fill in. Is it a number of bytes later? Is it an address just as is, or what? And another consequence of this is that, you know, this type of relocation can also allow us to have code loaded in different places in memory if they all have this type sort of relative location. And that, going back to the previous question about how do we deal with, you know, having things loaded at different points, there's another solution to that problem, is that we can make our code so we can load it anywhere in memory if we carefully write it so all the blanks in the machine code are of this form. And this is sometimes actually done by compilers. It's called position-independent code. Okay, so questions? Okay, so now I'm going to talk a few things about C. So in Z, much of this should be real. We have a bunch of data types. I'm going to tell you the sizes we're going to assume for this course. They aren't the sizes everywhere. So chars we're going to assume are 1 byte, shorts are 2, ints are 4, longs are 8, floats are 4, doubles are 8, and pointers are 8. That's what we're going to assume for this course. That's not actually true everywhere. This can vary all over the place. Another thing about C. C doesn't have, well, C basically doesn't have a bool type. It kind of does, but it doesn't work the way the C++ bool type works. And in particular, a consequence of this is that when you do a comparison, the result is an int, not a bool. You might say, what int is it? It's 1 if it's true, 0 if it's false. questions? Mark? So I told you that this comparison returns one if true, zero is false. You might say, what about two? Is two true? And the answer is yes. Here is the comprehensive list of false values in C. Zero is false. Zero converted to a pointer, also false. That's a null point. Everything else is true. Okay, so now let's talk a little about pointers in C. So this, I think, is something you've seen before in some form. So a string, if I have a string constant like this, it's going to be typically stored in some read-only data as an array of characters terminated by a null character, which is actually just the number 0. And the variable hello in this case will contain the address of the beginning of that array. Okay, so question, everyone clear on what's going on here? Okay, so now we have, seriously? Not a user. That is remarkable. So if we have this, yes.
So the variable hello contains the beginning of the array.
Question, the variable hello contains the beginning address of the array? Yes. So it's a hello is a pointer, so it just contains an address, and the address it contains is the address of the first character of this sort of array that's in some read-only memory. And hopefully my audio will work. Despite, yes, okay, good. Don't know why what I thought was the backup microphone doesn't work, but, okay. And you're probably familiar with sort of accessing things using pointers. And one thing we can do with pointers is called pointer arithmetic. We can add numbers to pointers. So hello plus 0, well, it's the same as hello. Hello plus 5 advances by 5 bytes. We're just adding to the number in the pointer. And we can dereference that pointer the same way we dereference other pointers and get the character at that location. Questions about what's going on here? This makes sense? Yeah?
Did you just did, like, print that variable hello? Would it just print the h?
Question, if I did printf the variable hello, would it just print the h? It would print the whole string, because printf expects its first argument to be a pointer to a string that is an array of characters with a 0 at the end. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? And so I have this way of sort of accessing different parts of this string. And there's another syntax for this that you might be familiar with, which is the array indexing syntax. Okay, so we have two ways of writing this. And there's a rule in C that these two ways of writing it are exactly equivalent. And I mean exactly. So this doesn't just apply to arrays of characters, it applies to all arrays. And it even applies to situations you think shouldn't be legal, like, say, doing this. Yes, that is legal and is equivalent to 3 plus string. So if string is a char pointer, it will add 3 to it, dereference it. No, you shouldn't write this, but it is a legal thing to write, and it has a defined meaning, because because array indexing in C is just a shorthand for pointer arithmetic and dereferencing. Okay. Questions? And I said these are exactly the same, and this applies to non-care arrays. So this means that when I add to a pointer that points to, say, int, so in this example, I have a pointer that points to the beginning of the numbers array, it adds not 2 to the actual pointer, it adds 8 in this case, because we have ints are 4 bytes. We have I want to advance by 2 of them, so it's going to add 4 bytes. And the compiler is responsible for implementing this, so the compiler, you know, the state store translation, is that it's going to generate an instruction that adds 8 to implement this plus 2. Because, and how is it going to know to do that? Well, because you declared the pointer in line 2 here as a pointer to int. So questions? About this process here. Okay, so since we've seen pointer syntax, arithmetic syntax, let's do this here. So we have some code that manipulates pointers to access this array here, which is a string. I want to say, what's the string afterwards? Who'd like some more time? A few people. Okay, so hopefully people still need more time. Okay, so let's say who thinks A, B, C, D, E. Okay, so we have a good majority for C, which is the answer I got. So I'll go through very quickly what I did. So we have our string foo, which is going to be stored in the stack. You might say, wait a moment. Earlier you said this was read-only data. So the difference here is I just had a pointer to a constant. And in this example here, I have an array I've declared that array is going to have storage separately from a pointer, you know, for 4 bytes. And that's going to be a local variable, so every time we initialize this variable, we make a new 4 bytes of storage for characters. So it's going to be on the stack because it's a local variable. That's probably where the compiler is going to put it. And we set pointer equal to foo. This is the same thing as doing pointer equals to the address of element 0 of foo. So we end up with pointer pointing to the F character. Then we dereference that and set it to B. Then we add 2 to it, making it point to the second O here. We set that to Z. I would recommend writing this not as an array indexing, but as dereferencing the pointer. I think it's probably better style, but they both do the same thing. And then we use some funny syntax to set the second character to A. I would probably write this as an array indexing rather than using the pointer arithmetic syntax, but as I said, they're the same thing. Some questions? Here, yes. How did the first character change? Okay, so when I set this pointer to equal to foo, that's the same as setting the pointer to point to the beginning of the array, the first element, so it points to the F here. And I dereference that and set it to B, so that changes it to a B. Other questions or follow-ups? Okay. So from sort of how all this pointer arithmetic works, it seems like arrays are kind of just pointers, right? And mostly. So just so you don't get into trouble with C stuff, so here I have an array and a pointer. And we can assign the pointer to the array, because I mentioned that's the same thing as making it point to the first element. We can't do the other way around. That's just illegal. It won't compile. And there's another way in which arrays are different than pointers. So the size of an array is the size of all the elements of the array. So in this case, I have a 100 element array of 4 byte ints, so the size is 400. Size of a pointer is the size of a pointer, how big an address is. Doesn't matter what it points to. And this is, I mentioned this because this gets a lot of people. A lot of people really want the size of a pointer to change them depending on what it points to. Sorry, it doesn't. It's not how it works. And similarly, if I make a pointer to the array in some sort of more temporary way, so what's the size here going to be? It's going to be 8, because this is a pointer. It's not an array anymore. Questions on these sizes. I'm mentioning this mainly because this second issue is a problem I see a bunch when people are trying to do some things with arrays in C. It's that they really want to use the size of operator, because it sometimes works, but if you aren't careful, you'll be using it in a case where it doesn't actually work, but also doesn't, like, not compile. Other questions? Okay, and So one other thing to go over that will come up much later in the semester, and that's just useful to know about C, is about how structs work. So structs in C are a little different than what you are probably used to from C++. So here I have a struct rational with a numerator and denominator, and I can use that struct by writing the type, which is struct rational. Yes, the whole thing. This is a difference from C++. The name of the type includes the word struct. Now, there's a way around writing the word struct all the time, which is a general thing. So C and C++ have something called typedef, which makes a new name for a type. So let's say I didn't want to write unsigned int all the time. I can use typedef to make a new name for unsigned int called uint. And then I can use uint instead of unsigned int. And well, we can apply this to integers, we can also apply this to structs. So rather than writing struct rational all the time, you'll see I have a way of avoiding that. And that is that I'm gonna, make a struct. And with some name, I'm deliberately I could have chosen the name rational. I chose another name to be less confusing. And I made rational an alias for it. And now I can use rational as a type. And you'll often see C code do this, and I'm showing you this pattern mainly so when it happens, you understand what's going on. Why aren't they just calling it other name for rational? This is why. Questions about this type def? Okay. And often people don't actually like having this other name here. They just want to call it rational. So you can simplify that. So one thing you can do to simplify it is that you can actually define the struct in the type def statement. Maybe C shouldn't allow this, but it does. So we're defining a struct in the middle of a typedef. And when we do that, here I've given the struct its struct name, struct name, in addition to the alias. I can also just forget to give it a struct name. And so you'll commonly see this syntax here, which basically gives it only a name rational. But that's where it comes from, and that's what that typedef is doing. And one other thing, so this means, note that if I do this, I'd like to point out that this other name here, I cannot use that name as a type name. Right? The name is either rational or struct other name for rational. I can't mix and match. Okay. Another thing I want to point out about structs that confuses people is that structs are not references. This is not Java. So if I assign one struct to another, it copies the struct. If I, for example, I make bar a copy of foo here, if I change bar, it doesn't change foo. This is a copy, not a reference assignment, like in Java. So this is not Java. This is a copy assignment, just like copying an integer. So questions about how structs work? Okay, so we're not going to use structs until much later in the semester, but since we talk about C in this class, I want you to know how they work, because if you read C code, you will see structs used, including with these weird typedefs, and it's useful for people to know what's going on. So one final comment about C. It's about what C is. So C started this programming language, but there's multiple variations of it. And there's been multiple attempts to sort of write down what it is. And sort of the initial attempt was in 1978. Kernighan and Rishi at Bell Labs published the C programming language. And what's defined in this book is commonly called KNRC. So the original version of the C programming language, the first edition, looks extremely different from modern C. Like how functions are declared, you would probably not really recognize. And then there was a standardized version, standardized by the American National Standards Institute, 1989, also adapted by the International Standards Institute in 1990, which looks basically like the version of C you're used to, called ANSI C. If you've ever seen the compiler action desk ANSI, that's what it's referring to. And this mostly looks like modern C. There was also an update in 1999 called C99, which added some features that you may have thought were always part of C, but in fact are relatively new. Features that were in C++, which is one reason why people may have thought they were always in C. Like declaring a variable in the middle of a block. Used to be, in older versions of C, that wasn't allowed. You had to declare all your variables at the beginning of a block that's after a pair of curly braces. Or using / comments instead of /* comments. That was, in fact, not allowed in the earlier versions of C. And later there were later updates, which are mostly more minor. Now, the thing about having a written version of what the language does is that, well, there's multiple implementations, and there's this writing that's written by these standards organizations that says, what is C, and you have to implement that. And they don't specify everything. So one example here. So here I have a function, test, which checks whether number plus one is greater than number. And I call it with int max. And if you remember how these complements work, you say, well, int max plus one, that's a really small number. Because that's how two's complements work. It wraps around. And if I compile this without optimizations, I get 0. If I compile it with optimizations, I get 1. And you might have the complaint, wait a moment, your compiler's broken. Why is it saying, giving a different answer when you have optimizations on? You know, that's just broken. But if you read the documents written by these standards organizations, my compiler is not broken. This is something called undefined behavior. They have decided that it is legal for a compiler to do this. And you might say, well, what's happening under the hood? Well, the optimized version, my compiler said, oh, if I add 1 to a number, of course that's bigger than a number. We're just going to return 1. Problem solved. And the code it generates doesn't even do the adding one. Just return. And the other version actually does the computation, reads the condition codes, and so on. And the reason this is allowed is that the people who wrote the C standard have decided that some things they don't care about what the compilers do. And one of them is integer overflow for signed integers. And they don't just say the compiler can give any answer. They say the compilers can do whatever they want. So another valid thing for my compiler to do would be generate code that's segfaults. And there are a bunch of things where the people who made the standard decided, we don't care what compilers do, and you'll get in trouble because compilers, like with optimizers, often take advantage of this, like in that example there. And one example is signed, not unsigned, signed integer overflow or underflow. So if you do that, yes, in two's complement it would wrap around. The specification for what the language C is says it does whatever the compiler wants. Another example is out-of-bounds pointers. Yes, it usually segfaults, but the specification says the compiler can do whatever it wants. Divide by 0, and a few other things. So that's where I'll leave today. I'll take questions.